Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. What you're about to hear is a recording of a live event that took place at the September 2025 edition of the Open Book Festival. In this year's edition of the Feminist Imaginary, Kumla Dineo Kola, Goretti Koyomohende, and Atambile Masola speak to Mbali's Kakana about writing feminist histories and filling in the gaps in the official archives.
Hello, how are you? Good, okay. Thanks for coming on a Sunday morning. We're all quite excited about this kind of turnout. Thanks. This morning, I've got a wonderful panel with me. I'm Mbali Skakane. I am a publisher / commissioning editor, Jonathan Ball. And we're going to do things a little bit differently. I want to introduce each of them, and then if you could give them a little round of applause. Let's unsilence them today. Okay. First, we've got Goretti Koyomohende. Her most recent work is Promises, Exploring Ugandan Immigrants' Experiences, Women's Agency, and Diaspora Connections. Her key themes are migration and diaspora experiences, and also she does institutional support for African women writers. She also explores connections between village and city life. She's a founder at the African Writers Trust and at FemWrite. Just a juggernaut. Round of applause. Next is Atambile Masola. Her latest is Inyati Ibuzwa Pambili, Theorizing South African Women's Intellectual Legacies. And it's about intergenerational knowledge transfer between women writers. We also did a book together called Noni Jabavu, A Stranger at Home, which was a really phenomenal project I'm proud of. Her key themes are intergenerational feminist knowledge, black women's intellectual histories, archival research, invisibility and erasure, African languages and literature, and most recently, ukufukama. Her background is she's a UCT lecturer, and she specializes in black women's life writing and historiography. So, then we've got Folusho Agbaje, and her latest is called The Parlor Wife. It's a historical novel. It's her debut, and it's set in Nigeria, Lagos, during the Second World War. Her key themes are women's empowerment in colonial Nigeria, cultural expectations versus individual agency, and African women's roles in liberation movements. She is from Lagos, but she lives in Dubai now, I know. So, and we also have a finance background together. Yes. You also studied accounting. Yes. So, round of applause. And then we've got the naughty one at the end, Pumla Dineo Kola. Yes. She obviously wrote Female Fear Factory, Gender and Patriarchy Under Racial Capitalism, ongoing acclaim for that one. And also Miriam Tladi, Writing Freedom. So she specializes in recovering and analyzing the work of pioneering black South African women. Her key themes are intersectional feminism, racial capitalism, gender violence, literary recovery, and African feminist imaginations, which is why she's on this panel. Mm-hmm. She is the NRF chair in African feminist imaginations at Nelson Mandela University and a leading feminist scholar. So. Okay, now to the boring part, the questions. kidding. All right, I'm going to start with you. Ooh. All right. Tell me why you wanted to do something as hard as writing a historical novel as a debut. Why?
So clearly I'm a masochist.
Yes.
but, you know, what I really wanted to write Can you hear me? Am I close enough? Okay. So I really enjoy reading historical fiction. I always tell people that I'm a writer, but I'm a reader first, and historical fiction has always been my favorite genre to read. But I realized over the years that I knew so much about World War II in other countries, and I knew nothing about what was happening to the people, to the women of Nigeria during the Second World War. And Nigeria was a colony of the British Empire at that time, so I found it strange that I knew nothing about it. So I remember one afternoon in 2018, I was talking to my grandparents, and my grandmother spoke about joining ration queues in Lagos, Nigeria. And I remember we were eating, and I stopped eating, and I was like, Grandma, I don't understand. Ration queues here. Are you sure it was here? And she was like, yes, of course. Like, every day, she had to join the ration queues with her siblings. And, you know, things were really hard, especially for those of us that were left at home. And it just got me, you know, spiraling down this rabbit hole of wondering what was happening to the women, the people who were left at home during the war. There's so many books about the soldiers, the people that went to fight. But I wanted to write a book about what war felt like in the home, intertwining grief, you know, the struggles of the women that were there, their love, their desires, the expectations that society had of them, especially in such a difficult time. So that's why I picked this topic.
Sure. So you're a researcher as well as a writer then.
I think I can officially say that after writing this book.
Pumla, tell me a little bit about excavating Miriam.
Miriam Tladi is, I don't really, you know, I'm not sure if excavating is the way I think about it, because the thing about Miriam Tladi is that she's not really neglected within literary studies. Mm-hmm. She is, in fact, for the bulk of her active publishing life, gets quite a lot of critical attention. She also is constantly in kind of literary community. She's a literary activist as well as a novelist and essayist and so on. So she's one of the founders of Staff Rider. So she's always in many ways for a long time throughout the kind of late 70s, 80s, 90s. She's getting literary criticism. PhDs are being written about her. Things are being published about her. She's not necessarily taught in English departments, but then I don't want to get into that. There's something about English departments. And I can't be too rude about English department. I mean, I can be, but you can't think about, like, it's your discipline, so you can be rude about it, but also, obviously, it's your discipline, so you're there, so there's something you like about it. But so she isn't generally part of the canon, even as people are publishing about her. And what's interesting is that there is then a lull as the older generation of scholars who are writing about her constantly. And of course, as many of her contemporaries also start to kind of get older and so on. So there's a lull in the kind of late 90s and to kind of 2010-ish, right? But she's alive. She's moving around in Johannesburg. So she's physically there. She's not as there as you would think someone who's produced as much as she has and has had as huge an active role in literary culture. In South Africa, but in Johannesburg specifically, would have. And so I write about, and so I think that maybe excavation is the right word. It is and isn't, right? So it's not like she's completely forgotten, but there's this kind of lull. Mm-hmm. And so writing about her is fascinating. And even as someone who fell in love with Tladi in my honors year, and this tells you as well, I wasn't, you know, obviously, that it's only in my honors year that I discover her. And she's mentioned, and I find her, but she's not taught. Mm. But I mean, also in all fairness, you can't teach everybody all the time.
Yeah.
Mm. And I've read her, and I've met her many times, and so on, and I've been in conversation with her, and Barbara Boswell, as kind of Barbara became the preeminent Tladi scholar. Writing this introduction to her teaches me a hell of a lot of things, too. And also about what aspects of her life and her life's work are not written about. So her short stories and her novels, I mean, her novel is part of the canon, like Amandla is part of the canon. And Mihloti gets talked about all the time, but nobody can ever find a copy of Mihloti, so nobody really knows what's in Mihloti. But, you know, so she's written about significantly. But she there's certain things that she writes consistently that are completely unwritten about, and those are things that don't make sense for what the critical expectation is of what a black woman mm-hmm. does. Mm-hmm. So her essays aren't. She writes a thing called a column, which isn't a column. Like, there's nothing about it that's a column. It's kind of micro histories, and so because it's a column that's not actually a column, we just, you know, that gets absolutely no attention. So that was quite fun, but also a little bit frustrating that someone who is by far one of the most productive South African writers of the 20th century and such an unapologetic, fierce feminist is just known by name, but most people wouldn't have read her.
Don't know her work.
But yeah, I mean, it was, I certainly enjoy the work.
I'm glad. I want to read something, a shout from the back of your book, Goretti. With her signature flair for raw, bold, honest fiction, Gyomhendo lays bare machinations in Kampala, the heartlessness of London, the resilience of Ugandans, and the ingenuity of desperate people. In Promises, Goretti Kyomhendo reaffirms herself as a major voice out of Africa. And that's Jennifer Nansubuga Makumbi, who wrote Shintu. And she was actually on the stage with me 2 years ago, sitting where Goretti is now. Oh, wow. And they are friends. How weird is that? Anyway, tell me about Promises between Kampala and London and writing about Africans in that migration.
Yeah, so when I started conceiving the idea to write Promises, I had just moved to live in the UK. Are you going to ask me why?
Why did you move to the UK?
Because I followed my heart and not my heart.
Does that mean is there a man involved?
I followed my heart and not my head. For the first time, I think. Anyway, so I moved to London, following my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then I start.
Do you want to tell us more?
What is? You're not asking.
What does following your heart mean?
Okay, let's talk about the book. So I'm in London, okay, I'm in London, and I meet and interact with a lot of immigrants. Mm-hmm. And usually my focus is on women, and this time I was looking out for Ugandans, and this is the storyteller in me, mm-hmm. because I really hadn't planned to go and start writing a novel at that time. I had published a novel a few years back. I had been working with FemRite for 10 years without ever taking leave. Sure. 10 straight years. So I remember telling myself, I'm just going to get an 8-to-5 job, mm-hmm. which I did, and lasted exactly 3 months. And then I started meeting all these people and interacting with them. And I said, there is a story here.
Mm-hmm.
There is a story here. There is a story of why these people decide to expatriate themselves from mm-hmm. their countries mm-hmm. and end up here. And I'm interested in that. Why do you leave? And maybe more importantly, why don't you just go back if things are so bad here? Because not a single one of them wanted to be in the UK. Even those who had been there for 22 years, 18 years, 5 years, 7 years, no one wanted to be there. So why don't you just go back if things are so terrible here? And for me, that's where the story was. Mm. And that's when I start creating Promises. But I keep saying that at the heart of this novel is a love story. I'm just a hopeless romantic.
You're just a lover girl.
I just believe in love. Mm. So at the heart of it, there's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
These are two young people, highly skilled, mm-hmm. highly educated, mm-hmm. highly experienced, mm-hmm. maybe not yet that experienced, but people just want to have a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And Uganda is not offering that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just caught up in that.
Yeah.
And then the man decides to leave Uganda and go to the UK with a promise, of making it big. And the main thing on his mind is, I want to make enough money and come back and wed my fiancé.
Ata, let's talk a little bit about the making of the Noni Jababu book and how difficult that whole process was. I'll let you tell the story.
Oh, my gosh. Because you come in at the tail end of that story. So, Kosi and I actually have written an article in Imbiza mapping out that journey. Because when we decided, here's a book, so maybe just some context, Noni Jababu publishes in 1960 and 1963. She's in London. South African writer, has moved there and lives everywhere, actually. And so, of course, he's done some research on her, and I was now doing my PhD. So we're like, most books, Drawn in Colour and the Ochre People only find when they go to secondhand bookstores. Mm-hmm. So we're like, what's the low-hanging fruit? How do we get these books published in South Africa? The Ochre People had been published by Raven Press in the 80s. So Drawn in Colour still hasn't been published in South Africa. We're like, okay, how do we do this thing practically? Because it's one thing to do a project, but to try bring that person back into circulation. So we have this chat and we're like, let's collect all the columns and put them in a book. Well, first you have to get permission figure out the permissions with the Daily Dispatch. And at the time, Daily Dispatch was part of a group, and so we had to figure that out. Then you have to figure out the copywriting. Thankfully, I had connections with the family already, so that was probably the easier part one way or the other. And then the publishers. And in the article, we use letters, and I wish we just used numbers, because I'd be like, we went through 10 publishers, basically, and we explain how everyone had a different reason for not wanting to publish her. Some people said she was outdated. Some people just didn't get it. Some people had wanted, because Kosi was working on the biography, people thought, we can just slip these in between the biography as like pictures. And we're like, no, there's something interesting that they can stand alone. So, other publishers just didn't think it was a substantial enough body of work. And the columns she writes in 1977 with the Eastern Cape newspaper, the Daily Dispatch. So, I mean, it kind of stops and starts and stops and starts. And then Bali comes into the picture in the most serendipitous way, because that day I was part of a symposium where Prof. Beggy Peterson, Kwezi Mkiza, and Kosi were part of putting together the book that then becomes Foundational African Writers, which has articles on Noni, Eske Mphahlele, Sibusiso Nyembezi, and Peter Abrams. So we're working on that. And I've just presented on Noni Jababu, and I leave. And I'm in the parking lot, and I see a missed call, and I never call back. But on that day, I call back. Turns out it's Mbali. Mbali's like, how you doing, girl? I'm in publishing. How's it going? And we chat, and I'm like, wait, there's this thing that now at this point, the Kosi and I have like lost steam. We're kind of just waiting it out to see when like the next kind of new energy will come to start bothering people again about this book. So I tell Mbali about this book, and I happened to be coming to Cape Town, and I took all the columns because we photocopied them and we put them in files, so we'd deliver these photocopies, and we're like, and when they said no, we're like, we want them back. And so I go to Cape Town with my stash, and that was the weekend. So the phone call, I think, was Thursday, Friday. Bali, I meet on Saturday, I give her the stash. By Tuesday, she was like, let's go. And I was like, how does this happen? For me, the beautiful part about that story is that like you called me on the day I was talking about her. So there's this like wonderful kind of serendipitous moment about that. But yeah, it was so striking that, of course, a black woman who's in publishing, you would get it and would then know what to do behind the scenes to like convince people that this book is worthy of being in the world. And now it's in the world.
Now it's in the world. You should get it. uh back to you, Felicia. I want to hear more about the research, but more than that, what was surprising in what you discovered? There's always these surprising nuggets when you do research like this. Tell me a few of those.
So I think what was most surprising for me was the work the Lagos Markets Women's Association were doing at that time. And it became such a big part of the novel because I couldn't ignore the impact they had had in Lagos during the 1940s when the Second World War was happening. I had never heard anything about it. And what was basically happening was the women in the markets were being asked to pay taxes that they had never paid before because the colonial government was trying to pay, was trying to use the funds from that to pay for the Second World War. And there were so many resources that countries across Africa contributed, you know, not even talking about the soldiers that went to fight, but all the resources in terms of leather, cocoa, raw materials that were sent across to the British Empire and prioritized in those places in the UK, taken away from Africa. And it just really showed me how sometimes women's histories are silenced, and I think that silence in the archives speaks for itself. Most of the research I did was written by men. Mm. Ironically, you know, we have had such a gap in some of these women's histories that sometimes it's difficult to imagine that women were living and breathing and contributing in that time. So the Lagos Market Women's Association and the struggle that they had to kind of make sure that the colonial government didn't take advantage of the women in the markets at that time was probably my biggest surprise. Mm. I think another big surprise was that in Lagos, there were zoning regulations. So during the colonial time, black Nigerians weren't allowed to live in the prime areas of Lagos, so Ikoyi and Victoria Island. And that was something I never knew, despite growing up in Lagos. Mm. I think, you know, we take it for granted that there's some parts of history that we hear so much about. But it's almost like the things that are so important and the things that you're like, that make you pause to think and, you know, wonder why it was that way. Somehow you just don't hear about it until you're scratching through the research. And that's really why I wrote The Power Wife. I tell people that it's a love letter to the women that history almost forgot and the resilience that they showed in very deeply complex circumstances.
Mm. Ah, I love that answer. Pumla, that relationship between silence and violence. Some of this silence is not passive, neutral. It's, you know, thinking about Female Fear Factory, for instance. Let's talk about why there is so much silence. It's not just happening. There is a violence involved. Mm. Yeah.
So I think silence in relation to violence there's several elements to it. There used to be, well, in the South African, Namibian, maybe I'll just say Southern African context, for a long time we said that the silence was about... So I'm old enough to remember that there was an advert by, some of you will remember. Okay, I know at least two people will remember because they're my age mates. And then I know that my favorite person in the audience sitting next to my other favorite person will also remember because she's a little older than me. Okay, no, she's maybe not a little. There was in 1990, I don't know, in the mid-90s, maybe 95, there's an advert that Rape Crisis commissions, and Charlize Theron is the talking person, and she says something about the stats of violence in South Africa. I was doing some work with Rape Crisis at the time, and there is a huge outcry, right? What do you mean, these crazy feminists? There's not that much rape. Why are you demonizing us? And da 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 and all of that. And so at some point, so then, you know, one of the feminist rallying cries here, as elsewhere, then becomes breaking the silence about the extent of gendered violence, patriarchal violence, rape specifically, but more broadly. And about how... I mean, we're a society founded on violence, right? As in our contemporary, like South Africa, Southern Africa is founded on violence, on slavery, on... So violence is like really how this incarnation of this region is forged. But there was, I think there's a huge denial about the gendered aspects of it. Fast forward to, you know, the now where everybody knows. So I think there's a different kind of silence. I've argued in some of my work that some of the silence is around who's perpetrating the violence. So now we know the stats. Everybody knows the stats. Everybody accepts the stats. But the next stage then is often missing. It's a dotted line to the next stage, which is about, okay, so what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. And now that we know the extent of it, and the silences are in part about who's perpetrating this violence and what that means, because if it's happening at that scale, we need to think about the perpetrators in relation to scale too, and I think we're struggling with that. But I think also there's despite all the work that we do, there's still some silences around why survivors, why victims respond in the ways that they do. I mean, it's incredible that when there's an instance of violence that permeates or that leaks into the South African public domain, still the vast majority of people who are like, oh no, we must end violence against women and children and queers. When confronted with examples, people still say, but what happened? What happened? What predated this attack? And why didn't you report? We have stats on how ineffective the criminal justice legal system is, and so on. And so those, there are silences, but I think they're a little bit more complex than the silences, I think, that we... And yet, interestingly, there's still the success of that campaign. And I mean, the advert was one instance of a very large kind of move, but... It's interesting that the success of that, as happens with many things, is now so loud, which is good, that it's still the thing that people will say rather than what the success of kind of saying breaks the silence about the extent of violence should enable us to do. So the silence, but also, of course, I think what you were intimating at is also the fact that we need to think about what silence means when it is chosen, mm-hmm. What it means when people don't report, mm-hmm. what it means, because now there's an obligation, mm-hmm. there's an obligation on largely women to disclose certain things. So even when you work in when you write on rape, often people will say, but how could you possibly know anything about it? You're not a survivor. And I'm like, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but why are you moving from the premise that, you know, it's like, can you disclose first? Can you disclose exactly which kinds and what? And, you know, and so silence is very, very complicated. And I'm very worried, and sorry, Mbali, I'm taking so long. I'm very worried that there's a new thing now that pretends that silence is only one thing. So now we say silence is complicity. Well, yes, sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
But silence is not... Sometimes it's refusal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's something else, right? And so I think it's very... I actually think it's very, very, very dangerous. This kind of oversimplification. It's like, okay, if you see silence and you don't know what's going... There's no requirement to try to understand
what
that is.
You don't interrogate further.
It's like silence. Why is Bali silent? Mm. Well... Yes, why is Mali silent?
There could
silent?
Be various reasons.
Yes. I mean, you're not silent. That's not what I mean. But, you know, I was just picking on you because...
Goretti, tell me about stories traveling, right? We're all scattered everywhere now as people, as Black women, as Africans. How do we still share our stories in a way that these archives can come alive? Wherever we are.
Yeah. So I can use my experiences. I think it was probably between 2003 and 2005. I was based in Durban, mm-hmm. writing a novel, my third novel. And for me, that was the first time I had ever written a novel outside of my home. That's the first time I traveled to another place to be able to focus on writing my novel. And I had everything set. This boy was so nice to me. I had my apartment. I had my food. Food, yes, of course. So there was no reason that I shouldn't have been writing. And I wasn't. And I was doing my writing in addition to my postgraduate training. And I had been appointed a supervisor. And we had talked about everything before I came, and I was all set with my laptop and everything, and I wasn't writing. And she became impatient. So this is one, this is two, this is 3 months, and there's nothing. And I started doubting the wisdom of doing that, of having come all the way, and I'd got a scholarship and all that, and I said I should just go back. And I couldn't understand why I was not writing. And then one day, I'm in my apartment, and I'm so frustrated. And I hear a dove singing. And I remember standing up and opening the window, and there was a dove in the tree and was singing. And was singing the song that my grandmother used to tell us what the dove says in that song. Hmm. I wish I could sing, but it will be very painful for both of us. So I'll not attempt.
Hum it.
No. I'm completely useless when it comes to that. Anyway, so the dove is singing the song that my grandmother so convincingly told me, that's what the dove says in that song. And I grew up on it, and I'm talking about it. I said, but this is in South Africa. Mm-hmm. How can the dove be singing that? So I'm bringing up this to say that day I wrote my first maybe 10 pages. So that's what I was waiting to unlock my creativity. Mm. Then that's on one side. Then, as I've said, I moved to London in 2007, and then I start writing Promises. When I say writing, I mean in my head. There's nothing on paper. And I've been so lucky. I've got a literary agent, and he's really one of the biggest. And we've talked about it, and he's so pleased with the story. Mm-hmm. And says, okay, go and send me the first 20 pages, the first 100 pages. I say, I don't have 100 pages. Then he says another time, what about 50 pages? I don't have 50 pages. Mm-hmm. Okay, send me 20 pages. Just that, we need to see how this story begins. And I still couldn't do that. Then I start calling my people back in Uganda. And I was doing it really subconsciously. So I'd get the phone, and then we talk. And for me, hearing the way we speak English, the way we express ourselves, the little nuances, That's what also opened up my creativity. So I'm bringing up these stories to say, indeed, how do stories travel? Mm. How can we continue? I don't know if I would have been able to write these two novels if I hadn't been reminded of home. Mm. I don't
how
know if that
just answers.
Answer
that off the top of your head, yeah. Like this. It's crazy to me
that you just had that, yeah, at the tip of your tongue to tell. Beautiful story. Thank you. Atta, tell me about this concept, ukufukama. What is it all about?
So in our book, the one you mentioned, Inyathibuzo Kwabaphambili, shout out to Phokazi, is here, she's one of the editors, with Babalwa Magoqwana as well. One of the chapters by Dr. Noma Thamsanqadisani uses this idea in writing about Diosoga. So Diosoga is kind of a very prominent figure in, I'd say, kind of a political consciousness, in that one of the famous hymns he wrote is Liza Lisidinga Lako, which took on a very political sense with the establishment of the ANC, but is kind of known as the father of black consciousness, studied in Scotland, came back with a Scottish wife, and this is 19th century. And kind of this family, the Soga family, becomes emblematic of African modernity, family of firsts, pioneers, all of that. And everyone always talks about Dio Soga as the father of that family, but no one talks about Nosutu, his mother, as the person who actually is written as, and she does something really interesting in kind of inserting herself into the archive, is that Chalmers, the person who writes Dio Soga's biography, can't not write about Dio Soga without writing about the mom, because the mom was like, here, take my son, I give them into your missionary care, and he goes off to Scotland. So that's the first way she kind of starts appearing in the archive. The second is when she writes a letter. He dies quite young. And she writes a letter to the missionaries, and it's published in the UPC, United Presbyterian Church, kind of report, missionary report. And she writes the letter, I say, but her daughter is the amanuensis person, but it's also translated. So it's this really interesting document that appears then in English in this missionary report. And so in order to, so Mam Disani, Dr. Disani is writing about this person, Unosutu, as ufugamile. So ufugama is when chickens, hens, thank you. Ufugama amaqanda.
Okay. You still have to.
In order for the eggs to hatch, you have to be there.
You have to
look and sit and nurture and hold and keep this thing. And that is what Unosutu becomes. And so this idea of ukufugama leads us to thinking about how other African women have created lineages and have kept their stories, their families, their kind of intellectual work in, through this way of ukufugama. I think someone like Miriam Gladie, in a sense, like, yeah, ukufugama, her own archive, there's something quite precious about how she keeps herself in the archive, in a sense, and at least the way I read it. I don't know why that came to mind. But, I mean, even the story of her having buried some of her work because of apartheid, that's a sense of ukufugama. You have to nurture, you have to keep, you have to, because there's this kind of, you don't know what's going to happen. There's no guarantees for black women sometimes of your own name, your own work, your own efforts, being able to make it into the future if you're in a precarious situation. So, yeah, and I think the work that we're trying to do right now, especially in that book, is about extending some of that work in a way, Nati. Even as you gather the archive, sometimes that feels like a nurturing and like a, and then you kind of hold all this archival stuff and then you have to make sense of it and then you have to let it out into the world in a variety of ways through the work. So even that process of like keeping people's stories, like now the project that we're working on with Spaz, Mbabala and Buleng is working with armed struggle veterans and helping them curate their stories so that they can be told. But just the process of it as well has been like, there's a sense of like, I keep like using this expression of like holding space for them. We do writing workshops. That's like another process of ukufugama, because it's not just that moment of sitting on the eggs and waiting for them to hatch, but something else is happening in order for that birth and that rebirth to be able to happen with the work. Yeah.
Sure. Very important.
I feel like you caught me off guard on like a Sunday morning and I have to like...
All of you are doing really well. It's like you were ready to go, so good. Folusha, tell me a little bit about the key women figures that have inspired you, basically, from Nigeria in the past.
That's a tough question. Yeah. Okay, I think over the years, I'll start with the women whose books I read as a teenager, Buchi Emechezha. Her work has been just amazing to read. And I think as a young girl growing up in Lagos, Nigeria, seeing that it was possible to put my thoughts together in a book and have it read by other people, not just my friends and my mom, was very, very encouraging. Sefi Atta, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and I think more recently, Abidare, who has, you know, she's her work is amazing and her writing is just so beautiful. And I've been privileged enough to have some mentoring sessions with her as well. That was a question, right? Yeah. Women that inspired me.
I'm going to go to Pumla. What is it about African feminist thought that is makes it distinct from other feminisms? And how can that help us unearth? Yeah.
I think there's several things. I think there's several things. I think that it's African feminist thought tends to be, first of all, pan-Africanist. It has that capacity to both be very mindful and care deeply about the particular context, and kind of a much more expansive sense of scale. Both in terms of, because you can't really be a serious African in the world and not think about various scale at multiple levels. In terms of time, just the, if you think about the multiple eras that we know about and don't know about, but kind of imagine, must have happened, must have existed, right? It's a very diverse. Because to say I'm an African is already to say something about rootedness, but also to say something about difference. I think the way in which, because we have such different histories, our own and the ones imposed on us, we have different, I don't even know how many languages, I'm not even going to try. We're very similar, but we also so different that sometimes if we did not have a certain deliberate consciousness, it wouldn't necessarily be clear why we are the same thing. And so African feminism is very attuned to that in terms of its treatment of difference, right? So I'm not just talking about we are aware of it. Yes, that's very nice. Everybody's aware of it. Oh, there's nothing feminist necessarily about that. But it does have a very particular orientation to difference. And so African feminist thought generally takes difference, first of all, as taken for granted, but also like unlike many other strands of feminisms historically and other traditions within the radical left historically does not take difference as a point of splitting and as threatening. So in African feminist thought, difference is taken for granted but also assumed to be a point of richness, so it enriches. So it's had this kind of very strange, if you think about it alongside other kind of left traditions in that very deliberate kind of kind of orientation to difference as a source, and you see this in a variety of things, right? You see in the ways coalitions are built, in the ways that the African feminist literary tradition, for example, it is very often. And it's wonderful to be sitting next to kind of Folusho, who kind of plays around with that. There's a very often a writing of a connected central figure. So very there's a tradition within African women's literary traditions and published in kind of novel form. Let me stick to that because otherwise nobody else will talk, because this is kind of my obsession and my day job, so I can just like speak for 15 hours and you'll die of hunger and starvation and thirst. But this notion of a paired, very often there are two figures, so usually two women who are very similar and very different, right? And this telling of a story. So whether you're thinking about the in the Francophone tradition, someone like Mariama Ba's most famous novel, it's the two friends who are best friends but do such different things. And you have to read that story. Or you're looking at someone like in the Southern African context, if you're looking at something like Tsitsi Dangarembga's Never's Condition, I'm only mentioning the famous one so that everybody can be in the room. but there's constant telling of self through a relationship with someone who's both your who's your mirror in both senses. So reflects you, but also is your is you back to front. And so in the very thinking of how African feminism makes and remakes the world and how it makes and remakes selfhood, difference is a part of that fabric. Whereas in many other strands of feminism and in many other strands of kind of left thought broadly, difference is a point of difficulty. You know, when like in this is why we have that framework of waves, for example. Each time those, I don't think talking about waves is a very useful way to talk about feminism in the world. And I don't think it was meant to, but I think, you know, some things that come from certain places in the world end up being universalized, even though they actually don't describe anything except a very specific place. And so I think that, you know, so we think about that notion of waves when we think about feminism in the world, that, you know, it's the second wave doesn't happen nicely. It's like there's a big fight, and there's a big fight, and there's a big fight, and there's a big fight, right? Or if we think about the history of nationalism anywhere in the previously colonized world, the idea when women start saying, excuse me, like, gender is important, or class is important, or sexuality is important, or location is important, or religion is important, it's a fight, right? The point at which difference enters is a fight. Whereas, kind of African feminists, that generally has, and I'm not romanticizing, and I'm using literature specifically, but, you know, there's a lot of work that would show it if we're looking at history and organizing, if we're looking at, you know, the part of the archive that Folu Shaw draws on, for example. If you think about the Aba Women's War, often called in colonial historiography, battle, riot, right? Riot. You think about the Aba Women's War, and you think about those strategies that are very similar. You see them in very different parts of the world, and you'll see them in, like, you know, you see them in naked protest, although Naminata Diabate complicates whether we should call it, but, so I'm not, you know, and I think that's convincing, but I don't want to take too long. And so both in terms of the traveling strategies that aren't exactly the same, but are very clearly rooted to, and so this kind of really deep interest in thinking through and working with and embracing the lessons and the richness that come with taking difference, not as something that's scary and frightening, being able to work in spite of it, which is not to say we don't fight. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying it isn't sometimes difficult, but I think one of the most distinct things about African feminism is that I've thought it's just you have to deal with difference. And sometimes you deal with it well, sometimes you deal with it badly, but there's no kind of trying to get around it or escape it.
We don't pretend around it. Gretzi, tell me a little bit, actually a lot, about your work at FemRight and why it was so important to do that kind of work.
So FemRight, for those of you who are not familiar with it, FemRight is the Uganda Women Writers Association. So we coined the term FemRight to represent both our gender and our professional identity. So Fem for female and Right for female writers. And I got involved with FemRight in 1995, and that's when we established it. 30 years.
Yes.
30 years this year. Wow. Yeah, so I got involved in FemRight when I was writing my first novel, which was later to be published in 1996. And the whole idea behind FemRight was really simple. How do we get to have more women voices in the country? So Uganda, I keep saying, was the literary cradle of Africa. In 1962, the first ever African Writers' Conference of Writers of English Expression happened in Uganda and was attended by all the literary heavyweights. And I keep saying, and those who would later become important. So Chinua Achebe was there. Ngugi wa Thiong'o was a student at the university, Makerere University at that time, and was writing his second or first novel, The River Between. So these were the participants of the conference, but even at that conference, there were hardly any women writers. I think there were about maybe three or so women writers. And then we come into the 70s. So after the literary production that had happened in the 1960s, then we come into the 1970s, when we have Idi Amin. I'm sure many of you identify Uganda with Idi Amin, sadly. So somebody was asking me, so is Idi Amin still killing people in Uganda? Wow. I said, no.
Quite out of touch.
I said, and why is that? I said, well, because he died.
Yes.
He died.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, so the early 70s, for the next 9 years, we have Idi Amin, and everything we had achieved in the 1960s, when literature was associated with Uganda, goes down. And I keep saying three things happened to Ugandan writers. They were either killed, or they went silent, it was too dangerous to write, or they went into exile. So the whole of the 1970s into the early 80s, we are going through political turmoil. There's a time we had 7 presidents in 7 years. Mm-hmm. So it was really bad. Then come the 1990s, when we have new leadership. And we still have the same president. 40 years later.
Yes.
So there is some relative stability. I shouldn't be talking about that unless I don't want to return to my country. Anyway, so there's some relative stability, and I keep saying femrite emerged out of that. You know, when the country started rebuilding after the political turmoil we had gone through for about 20 years, femrite emerges out of that. And for us, our concern at that time is, where are the women writers? Women are traditionally the custodians of stories. Women are the storytellers. Why are they not writing? Why are they not getting published? And we put out a call, and I think the first meeting we got about 32 women writers, Ugandans. And these were different categories, young writers, you know, just finished university, or women who had been writing and keeping their manuscripts. And for us, the first question is, why have you been keeping this manuscript? It is really beautiful. And they say, well, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. There was only one mainstream publisher in the country at that time. And the others who were not writing but had the interest and the ability to write. The main question was just sheer lack of confidence to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. And I keep saying that in Africa, at least in Uganda, where I'm familiar with, a woman's identity is constructed using that of another. So if you are the mother of John, you'll be referred to as Mama John.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Same here.
If you are the wife of Peter, actually in Uganda it's a bit different because we have a prefix, which is Mu, M-U. So Mo means the wife of. Mm. So I keep saying that's different from being Mrs. Mm. Because if your name is, if for example my husband was the one called Kiomhendo, I would be called Mukiomhendo, which means I'm the wife of Kiomhendo. So what does that do to, what does those multiple identities? If you are a daughter of somebody, you also take on your father's name. What do those multiple identities do to you as a woman writer? Mm. When you start writing, you are going to think of, how can I use the F word? Mm-hmm. when I'm the mother of John, what will John think? and his friends? What will my in-laws think? What will my father think? Mm. So the first thing we did was to create personal empowerment training workshops, not skills development, because these women had the basic skill, the talent, to tell their stories, but it was just that lack of confidence. How do you push back against those multiple identities and be a woman writer an African woman writer who can be able to tell their stories. I'll always remember one of the first stories that we received. I still remember the opening line. I was raped on my wedding night. And I remember sitting up and saying, what a beautiful opening to a story. And we encouraged this woman, please go ahead and write the story. So the next time she brings it to us, she has changed the voice and is reading, Angela was raped on her wedding night. Mm. I says, well, you see, what will my husband think? Mm. Because people are going to ask, who raped you on your wedding night? Well, this is fiction. Mm. So those are the things we are battling with, to empower the women to tell their stories. Mm. So that is the genesis of FemRight. And really proud to say that 30 years, I'm just remembering 30 years this year, that 30 years later, there are probably 44 publications. Mm. Mm. Uganda, thank you.
Wow. Atambile, you know, sometimes when we are looking at women's legacies and writing and their achievements in whatever sphere, sometimes there are contestations about those legacies, aren't there? I'm going to bring you to your very spirited intellectual engagement around Charlotte Maxeke and how that played out. I think it's important to have those types of things play out in the public and for people to understand that women's legacies are robust enough for those discussions. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, my gosh.
How much time do we have?
Maybe you should give more context to what happened. So 4 years ago, Panache Chigumadze wrote 2 articles in the Sunday Times about Charlotte Maxeke. I think it was around the time of, it was the year of Maxeke. Yeah. The ANC has this weird thing that they, the centenary year of, except it wasn't a centenary year of with Maxeke. I think it was 100, and she would have been 120 years, those kind of birthday years. So Panache writes these 2 articles, and then I wrote 2 articles in response. And I think it's this question of difference and difficulty, and I think we must have debate. And I'll pick up on one of the threads that I was responding to in that dialogue, I guess, was the question of citation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a big one, I think, in feminist writing about when other people have done the work. So here's the thing about the writing of Maxeke. I think there's been a long conversation, actually. And I think even the way in which the ANC has, at times, I felt, co-opted her, because there's this conflation of the ANC Women's League, the Bantu Women's League and the ANC Women's League are one and the same thing, and they weren't. The Bantu Women's League was the Bantu Women's League, and then the ANC Women's League comes out of a particular tradition. But there's been at times this kind of like, because the ANC wants to give itself this impression that it has always had women there. But Charlotte Maxeke was the only woman present in 1912. And there were actually many other women's organizations. And the ANC only allows women to become members, I think, in the 1940s. Mm. So there's this weird relationship. And so using the figure of Maxeke, and it's a long thing, because there was a creche named after Maxeke in exile. So the ANC has this relationship of wanting to kind of, she is the mother of freedom. But in those specific articles, Panache wrote as though there hadn't been a biography of Charlotte Maxeke written by Zubeda Jaffa. And instead of kind of saying, this is a long conversation, here are all the people who've been writing about it. Tozama April had a thesis written on Charlotte Maxeke. So it was just weird to me that how do we write this work to say, we're in conversation with each other. I'm bringing this part of the conversation. This person's already brought in this part of the conversation. And I think it's an ongoing thing in the introduction to Surfacing, Khabiba and Desiree's edited volume. They talk about the same thing, where African-American scholars do not cite
black women from the global south, particularly, as though they are the be all. And so there's something about this tussle about who is, how do we do citation? I mean, obviously Panache also responded, and then I didn't respond back. I just sent her an email and I was like, I saw your piece. We'll chat when we chat. And yeah, we haven't all these years later, which is weird. But yeah, I think that it needs to be said when we see, and I think I really like what you said about difference. I'm not a fighter. I'm never like, I don't think the space should be about fighting. And I think a lot of people, when we were having those chats, it was as though I'm fighting Panache. I wasn't fighting her. I think I was just pointing something else to say, let's have this conversation in a way that grows and in a way that takes the long history into account, that we're also not the first to do this. I mean, Shireen Hasim at another gathering was not taking, I don't know why I'm using the expression taking beef, but she pointed out that my relationship with Noni Jabavu from a place of erasure, she's like, rather think of it as circulation, that just because you didn't hear about it, it doesn't necessarily mean erasure. Maybe in your specific context, there was erasure, but she was like, we were talking about Noni Jabavu in the 80s, and then what happens, how do we account for the gaps in between so that we're not always claiming firstism, we're not always claiming recency as though you are now the first person to be discovering this, because there's this inclination to also just keep discovering. Mm. Black women somehow seem to also be the people who constantly need to be discovered.
Perpetually discovered, yeah.
And so I think it's a caution to me in that way of like, let's have this conversation in a way that says, maybe how come I don't know about this person, or how am I coming into this conversation in a way that will make the circle bigger in a sense.
Mm. And, you know, in keeping with that, I'm going to ask you all the same question. What are the voices that we should be looking out for now that you're aware of so we can circulate that in this room? Especially the academics.
I mean, it depends what you're looking for. And I think that there are a lot. And if I'm a little conscious that we mention certain names and then...
Next thing.
And then, and then as soon as we finish talking, we're like, oh, I didn't mention these 500 names. I think that we need to be generally curious, right? I mean, I think that there's so much... It's important for us to not work from the assumption, unless we know for a fact, that we're the first, that we are finding. So people will say, nobody... I mean, I'm still in rooms where people say, nobody's written about Noni Jamavu. And I'm like... Nobody. Really, in 2025. Like, there's new books on her. You know what I mean? Or someone will say, nobody teaches Miriam Tladi. And I'm like, Or someone will say, this is the introduction of feminism to the Eastern Cape. I'm like... are we trying really, really hard? Not, or someone will say, I am the first person who's trying to write a novel as a feminist in the Xhosa literary tradition that's 200 years old. I'm like, really? Like, people, like, have you read Atambile's scholarship on this? Like, you know, so I don't want, I'm not saying we shouldn't mention names. I think that it's important to have the curiosity and just try and, you know, like what Atambile is saying about, think about, why? Where might we be able to get a sense of who has done the work? And even those of us whose life's work is committed to this resurfacing, not recirculation, mm-hmm. and different circulation, mm-hmm. and disagreement in ways that are generative, which is not to say not difficult. Like, nobody really wants to be... I mean, Bibi Bakare Yusuf said something very interesting during the conversation and the disagreement between Atambile and Panache, and it stuck with me. I mean, I got a bit irritated with Bibi at the time, because sometimes you get irritated with your friends when they write. and she said, "What you in this moment in Southern Africa are taking for granted is the fact that it is possible for two feminists working in the same" or not same tradition, to be able to have this discussion, that it's possible at all, and to be able to have it publicly, and to have it, you know. And so I think that that's important. But I think it's also important to understand that not knowing something exists doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There are long traditions of women writing, organizing. You know, we have no shortage of kind of writers. And I think, so I'm not answering your question by naming people, because I don't want to do that, but it doesn't mean someone else can't do it. As people that people because I'm very anxious about leaving people out. And also, to be honest, the history of 20th century South African literature is about turning away from bodies of black writing. So that you can pull out certain specific people. And so I'm not doing it because I'm being nice. I'm doing it because I think that part of you know, we know certain names out of, and maybe the question we should, maybe the for me, a slightly more generative way to ask your question, because I think it's an important question. So I'm not saying let's not ask the question. I don't even think it's the wrong question, but maybe it's a question that needs a little qualification, is to think about where are the sites of this work? What should I be reading? Which archive should I be reading? How do I read? Because, I mean, you can't assume that people who are trained in history, like Atambile, like everybody knows what an archive is, especially at a time where we're saying archive for everything. Like, I have a few rocks, it's my archive. No, it's not just a few rocks. you know, I have lots of sneakers. It's an archive. No, it's not an archive, it's a collection. I think that, so there are certain sites, like, so maybe Atambile can talk about some of it, but like, read Staff Rider. Right? Go and read it. Because actually, what you think is in Staff Rider, you are wrong. Go and read Staff Rider. Go and read the Drum Archive.
I mean, that's a name. Drum and Staff Rider name.
Like, Staff Rider is digitized, so you can find it. Like, every single issue of it is. Go and read it. You'll be surprised who the women are. You'll be surprised what they're doing. You'll be surprised at whose names you've never heard of and why you haven't heard of them. Go and read. Okay, Atambile will say the other things. But you know, what are those sites? What are the literary... Go and read the literary... I mean, if you're talking about literary history specifically, go and read the... I mean, South Africa has a very, very rich history of literary magazines. Sometimes they're not really literary magazines, but they're called literary magazines. So, yeah. And so that we're not doing this thing of constantly discovering, right? Which I think we work so hard to challenge even that conversation. But it's an important one. I'm done. Take over.
The one I was thinking of, which I thought you'd mention, Women Writing Africa, has like completely changed my life. The Northern, Southern, Eastern African, it's like a four collection tomb that we sometimes, I don't know if it's because we never kind of see it in that full collection, but there are names there. And the Southern one, I think Wits Press did here, but it was published by Feminist Africa, I think, which is in New York or something, but it hasn't been reissued. But
no, Feminist Press.
Feminist Press, sorry.
Feminist Africa is definitely not in New York.
Please report me. Thank you, Feminist Press. But that has helped me, because it's like a collection of like from 6th century BC all the way to the 2000s. Sure. So from north everywhere, you know. And I think it also gets us out of just being, so it helped me at least to kind of get out of the south. And I was just revisiting the East African one, and it's got letters, it's got essays, it's got poetry, it's got songs, it's got, and so, and another thing about the archive, like the textuality of it is so vast, and people have done this work of like making it multiple in multiple ways, because for a long time the archive was what the white men had written. And now in disrupting that, you actually, and I mean the people who put this together, I don't want to mention names because I'm going to forget them, but it's also just teams and teams of people. And that's another thing about that relationality of this work, is that it's always teams and teams of people, in fact, who then make this work possible. So that was like a complete game changer for me. And I still go back to it.
Say the name again.
Women Writing Africa. So you get four volumes, the Southern Region,
the Eastern region, Western and Sahel, and the Northern region.
Important. Mm. Thanks.
Huge.
And also women publishers on this continent. There's a fantastic book. I haven't read it, but I saw there's a just go to everybody has a website. Go to FemRight. Go to Cassava Republic. Go to, we have such a, go to Mujaji. Go to, you know, it, for a sense of a historical but also a contemporary moment with so many incredible women, like women's, whether they're feminist or not, doesn't, but, you know, some are feminist, some are just, but go to those websites. Go look at, there's a, go buy the collection. If you don't know who they are, there's a collection of conversations with publishers, which publishers, I mean, you publishers are very sweet because you're actually very self-effacing, right? But actually there's a book now, I haven't read it, so they're not paying me to promote it, of conversations with African women publishers. Oh, so go look at, go get the book and read who they are and Google them and stalk them online, and then you'll have a set and look at their websites and who they're producing, and then we get a sense of, you know, who some of the names are historically. And
thank you for that reframe, because now we have many, many, many names.
Can I also add to that, that there's also another anthology called New Daughters of Africa, published, edited by Margaret Busby. Mm-hmm. I think there are over 200 women writers of African descent.
And yeah, there's like so much work that's been done that we just need to dive into at the end of the day. I want to open it up to questions. Do you have anything?
No, I just, you know, it's just a thought I've had over the last 3 days. And when you asked that question about the voices we should be listening to, it's something that, it's a question that's been playing on my mind. And I think, you know, I want to throw this out there. I think we need to hear a bit more from African YA in terms of feminist voices and what's being written in that space. I feel like it's a space that, you know, we don't, at least not to my knowledge, like we don't have book festivals like this for YA. We don't have book clubs en masse for YA. And I know the power...
Young adults.
And, you know, in the power of fiction, in adding texture to our stories, I do worry, especially now that there's a lot less, well, there's more literacy, but we're trying to encourage people to read more as opposed to being on screens. Mm. And I worry that, you know, we're so focused, and again, I'm still forming this thought because it's one that's been forming over the last 3 days. We're so focused on, like, what voices are we listening to that tell the stories of the past and are important for the future. But then, the you know, a very big chunk of the future are our young adults and the children that are reading books and the young people that are reading books. And I really do want to think a bit more about how to pull them into the conversation a bit more. Mm.
Mm. Questions? Anybody? Ah, there. Ah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The question is for Lucy. I just want to ask you, what do you hope the book achieves when it gets to the hands of the readers, especially in shaping feminism and activism for Nigerian women, given the climate right now in Nigeria?
Mm. What I want is for people to understand that women in 1940s Nigeria had the same desires as women in 2025 Nigeria and around the world. That quest for agency and recognition and empowerment is the same. You know, my protagonist, Kehinde, was in a polygamous marriage, wanting to fight for women's rights, wanting to be a writer, wanting to do, you know, her, wanting to spend her life doing the things that made her fulfilled. And, you know, there's the danger of reading history and just seeing, you know, black and white pictures and text, and these people almost seem two-dimensional. They don't feel like real people. So I really want people to read The Power Wife and understand that, you know, these were real people's lives. Fictional, but very much based on the desires the women had at that time and how it is the same. And usually, the path to fulfillment and empowerment is the same. You have to take control of your life and not expect the control to be given to you by the people in power.
Hello. Yes, thanks. This question is, my name is Fezile. This question is for anyone on this stage that really wants to chime in. I've been thinking a lot about what the future of writing looks like, and I haven't heard people talk about artificial intelligence. look, we've got two generations of writers on the stage. You've got Sis Pumla and Ogoretti there, but older. I don't know what you think about AI.
What?
And then you've got...
Ogoretti's 12.
Where are you? I said I'm old. Show your face. I can't see them.
More advanced in the writing journey. And then you've got younger generation, Atambile and Folushu there. And what does the future look like? So are you guys going to use AI to write? Are you going to prompt AI? Because the idea is still yours. You know, Ugoretti was talking there how she procrastinated in Durban. In terms of writing, she says she took 3 months to put, you know, pen to paper. That's something that AI could potentially speed up. So I'm saying, how does the future of writing look like? Does AI not include, are you guys going to write word for word? How's it going to work going forward? Do you have any views? Is this something that's being discussed in the writing circles? What is the future of writing in terms of AI?
Can I just punt my session? We're going to be talking about that later.
Funny,
so
yeah,
just
you
come
were saying.
At 2 o'clock. Hmm. That's how I'm going to answer that.
Good. No answers.
What do you think?
Me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, he's saying that. I wish I could see his face. He's just hiding. Hiding somewhere. He's saying AI would have written my novel when I was failing to get to be creative. I don't know. I really hesitate to be discussing AI because I keep saying or feeling that we really don't know how far or how much AI is going to impact our creativity, our writing. And for me, I always want to equate AI to when television was created. And everybody said, oh, nobody's going to listen to the radio anymore. You know, the radio is now useless because television gives you the visuals, and who would want to listen to the radio when you can tune in TV? So I go back to that time and say, maybe we shouldn't be too worried about AI, because at the moment we don't know how far it is going to impact our lives. And also to say at the moment, I just take what AI is able to offer me. When my work was translated recently, first in French, and also Spanish and other languages. And I remember when they sent me the text, I just feel so useless because I can only read in English and my mother tongue. So I get sections of it and paste it into AI. And I feel good. I say, well, at least now I have an idea, apart from just recognizing my name in this. At least now I can tell a little bit. So I just want to just snippets of what AI is able to offer me. But really, I don't think I have much more to offer on that subject. Mm-hmm. Because it's, for me, something that is evolving. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on the sidelines and saying, how far is this thing going? Mm-hmm. You know, is it going to take over my life? Or can I just use what is available to me at the moment and just sit back and wait and see?
Mm. Can I
I'm sorry to disappoint the person asking, whom I can't see.
Yeah, just to add to what Grassi's already said, I think anyone who's written a book will tell you that it's a very messy, very messy process. There's no amount of delay in your writing process that AI can solve, honestly. Mm. There's so much beauty in the mess of it that I don't believe AI can replace that. So I think AI can assist, but it can never replace. And I've been, you know, to the part of your question that says, have we ever used AI? I've been working on my second novel, and there's many sections are in Pidgin English. In Nigeria, we speak, you know, everybody has different languages. There are 500 plus languages in Nigeria. But Pidgin English is the language that most of us can speak. So to the level of going to AI and saying, how does this sound in terms of pidgin? That's helpful, but it can never actually write the dialogue for me. It's not, I don't think that is possible. And maybe I'm being naive in saying that, you know, to the extent that Garati said, we can't see what is going to evolve. But I don't think it can ever replicate the beauty of that mess that the human mind produces in creating arts of any kind.
Can I also just say one thing? I agree with what's been said, but I'm reminded, like Goretti, of the way in which it's a technology, it's a resource, we can use it, we already use it more than we think we do. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of it that we resist. I think it's inevitable that it's going to infuse larger and larger parts of human life. I don't think that it's going to replace human creativity. I don't think that it's, and we're sitting as people who teach also as well, looking at, it's causing a lot of interesting things, creating interesting things, but it's also causing a lot of havoc in the capacity of people to learn how to read. And I'm saying this as someone who kind of works in the academy and you can see some of the benefits, but you can definitely see some of the kind of, and those things will evolve. But even, you know, it's like when the internet started, like technology has a politics, and it has a power, and it has a thing. It's none of it is kind of innocent. You know this. You know, when the internet started, like so many people were saying, oh, my God, it's going to be the great equalizer. Mm. Well, no, it hasn't, right? Because, like, everybody can hop on and so, but we still have knowledge flows forming in certain kind of ways. And so I don't think AI is, I don't think any technology, old or new technology, is going to do the kind of supplanting, and we think it might, it's going to obviously change some things, like we have fewer physical newspapers now, for example, from a different technology, right? But I don't think it so there'll be a mutation, but I don't think it can ever replace the imagination. Will AI write novels? Yes, it is already doing it. But does that mean the only novels and the only books we're going to see are going to be AI ones? No, I don't think so. I think that the human imagination and the artist's stubbornness is enduring and rewarding and life-making. And I think that we will be very, very... I think we're doomed as the human species if we think we can hand over creativity to AI, because we are more than just remixing and algorithms and possibilities of what's already out there. We are, you know... Writing is there's a witchcraft to it, right? There's like a weird thing, like magic that you can't explain. And AI will be great, but I don't know that it'll be witchy in the same way.
This has been really fascinating. I really like what Poluso said about the power of fiction to add texture to some of the stories. And I wanted to ask, I'm not sure who, I like that there's novelists and nonfiction writers and studiers of fiction all together. In terms of the gaps that archives have of finding texture of lives, sometimes you'll get a name or an event, but not that texture, of how you bridge the gap between writing fiction, writing nonfiction, and critical fabulation in the middle, and if any of the nonfiction writers have thought of writing fiction when the archive isn't enough, and to fill that gap, yeah, just opening that space.
But all four people on the stage who are writers write fiction, and some of us write fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So there are no...
There's not a... Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's Atambile and me who are supposed to be not fiction writers.
Very much.
But we've written and published fiction, so I don't...
And
I can
poetry.
Answer the question.
And poetry.
Atambile, answer the question.
Okay.
Now that I've said the footnote.
Yeah, I mean, when you were asking your question, what came to mind, and you used the word fabulation, right, and that's been coming up a lot, critical fabulation with Sadia Hartman's work. But I think... especially what you were describing in terms of your work, that's already happening. You know, historical novels are doing that. So to what Pumla is saying, I come from literature and I found myself in a history department. And kind of to maybe the bane of the historian's shock horror, because sometimes instead of
writing the history. In 18 bloody blah, this is what happened. Like, I recently wrote something where I was like, I found all these things. You don't find them in the same order. And so I wrote about finding them. So I found someone's obituary before I found out where they were born. Mm. And you write that. Mm. You just explain that as it is, because that's what you're finding. So I can't, someone was like, maybe it's like, it feels a bit meta, but I don't know. I wrote about the process of finding the stuff. And there's room now to be able to do that rather than to pretend like you've got all the information and you wait it out and then you write. That's one way of doing it. Other people want to be able to wait and write everything. In the same piece, I then tried to imagine the conversation between these two women. Because there's an instance where they're both at a... they're the only two black women at this one woman's wedding. Let me just use their names. Kwacha and Dawse Soga are at Kwacha's wedding, and she is getting married to, I've forgotten her husband's name, but I can see his picture. But anyway, and I was just trying to imagine what it's like for Kwacha not to have her family at their wedding because they're being married off as like this perfect missionary project that was happening in the 19th century. Mm. And I wrote it, and it's an academic paper, but there I am kind of fabulating and trying to imagine what they would have sounded like, how Kwacha would have felt on her wedding day, not having her family there, and then trying to imagine who Dawse's family is. I only know her father. I don't know her mother. And so, yeah, it's happening already. And it sometimes you just feel like you don't know what you're doing, really, and then you end up doing it, and then people kind of get it. But I do think we're at a place now where some of those options are available. Or you write a poem, and it ends up being a conversation between two women because all you saw was a photograph. Mm-hmm. So there's just various ways. And I think now more than ever, there's just so much more freedom.
Yeah. But also fiction is... For me, really, is writing about something that is real and just reimagining it, refunctioning it, retelling it. So sometimes the line between fiction and not fiction for me is very thin.
Yes. Paper thin. Yeah, we won't have the time to continue. However, this has been an amazing session. Thank you all for being here. Lovely audience.
Thanks for listening. This event was made possible by the support of the City of Cape Town, the Heinrich Bull Foundation, and the Wheatfield Estate Foundation Trust.